because of what I do in the museum and because of what my interests are, which is always the transfer of knowledge between the Islamic world and Europe via Jewish scholars, this will be a wild mix of Islam, of the Islamic world, of Europe, and a little bit of the influence zone of Jewish scholars, all mixed in and all going in various directions. But when we talk about the astrolabe in cultural context, what I would like to do this evening is to talk about what an astrolabe actually is, and where astrolabes were known, and who owned them, or who used them, or who understood them, which is not necessarily the same thing. So who would actually have used and understood an astrolabe in the European Middle Ages? Now, the catalogue of astronomical instruments, which Professor David King at the Institute of History of Science at Frankfurt is putting together, or has been putting together for a very long time, he's retired now, and we're still waiting for the catalogue, eagerly, lists about 150 astronomical instruments from the Middle Ages. So, publications have confidently claimed, based on that number, because these are listed on the internet, we've got access to that, based on this number, that the astrolabe was the instrument of the Middle Ages and quite widely used and understood. So, who would have understood these instruments? Well, monks, obviously, because they had access to learned texts and the recent translations from Arabic, and time to peruse these texts. And when you look back at the role of astrolabes, Jim and I were discussing this earlier, and anyway, in any case, it was probably a slightly bad timing that I'm giving this talk just a couple of days after Jim did his table talk on astrolabes. Probably people are astrolabed out by now. But we were discussing earlier this evening why there is a fascination for astrolabes. And in my recollection, long before I myself actually got into the subject, a very long time before that, there was one image which changed people's view of astrolabes forever. And some of you may remember that. And it is obviously monks who, as we can read here, clearly believed in God but traded with the devil. Generally got involved in all sort of hanky-panky in the pantry, if you remember the film, and looked suspiciously like Sean Connery, who changed our view of the astrolabe, because in case you've never looked at this poster properly, the astrolabe's right there, you know, between Sean Connery and Murray Abrams. But whilst in that film, Brother William, who Sean Connery is depicting in this context, is using this astrolabe very secretly and is hiding it from view, and therefore gives the impression this is a bit of an object which not everybody was particularly comfortable with, which becomes quite clear during the course of the film, one would imagine, because we have such a large number of instruments, that there were others, astronomers or other practitioners, who used the astrolabe quite widely for all sort of reasons. Well, the question is, is that true? So let's revisit the Middle Ages and see what we can find. 150 instruments from the Middle Ages sounds quite impressive. But when we say Middle Ages, or when I say Middle Ages, because I come from a different cultural background from academic training, I probably means, or I know that I mean something completely different from my colleague along the corridor in the British Museum. And if I asked five people in the audience what they think Middle Ages is, we probably get five answers or more. So Middle Ages being a very, very long period of probably around more than 1,000 years, it may come as a surprise that there are actually very, very few early astrolabes from Europe, that is. If one looks closely, most of those 150 instruments which I've mentioned earlier come from just after 1250. Now, 1250, you may be aware, or the 12th and 13th century, are the centuries of the great translations, the translations from Arabic into Latin, when this new knowledge was adopted, and developed further. So this is probably not surprising. But the greatest number of those instruments are after 1300, so actually quite late in the Middle Ages. And that's exactly the period when Chaucer wrote his treatise on the astrolabe for his allegedly son, may have just been a young boy. And I always like to show off the collections of the British Museum, because there are quite a few instruments of this type around. But ours is the only one which is dated. And this is the earliest dated European astrolabe in existence. It's dated 1326, and it's exactly the shape and the type which Chaucer describes in his treatise. Now, this is rather interesting, because at roughly the same time, other instruments appear at court. Instruments are discussed. Whether they were used, we're not entirely sure about, but they were discussed in court circles. The famous quadrants, which we also have at the British Museum of Richard II. So there's definitely an interest in the material. So if they are so late, what happened earlier? And where do they actually come from? Now, there is one man to blame for this, and that is Claudius Ptolemaeus, or Ptolemy, as we normally refer to him. It's a bit of a shady image on the left. This is why I've cut him out in detail, and he's, as I'm sure you all know, holding the astrolabe in a way which you would never, ever hold it in if you want any readings. And of course, he was slightly confused by the creator of this miniature with the dynasty in Egypt of the same name, and this is why he is depicted as a king. He was nothing of that sort. He was an astronomer, astrologer, geographer in Alexandria. That's nowadays in Egypt, of course, but at the time, well, it was also then in Egypt, but at the time was Hellenistic influence, so enormous amount of the Greek knowledge coming together there. And Ptolemy worked in the second century of the Common Era, so it's about 150 years after the birth of Christ. And it's commonly associated with the astrolabe, but it's very, very likely that he used older sources. A Greek astronomer called Hipparchus, who is on the other side of birth of Christ, about 150 years before the birth of Christ. His original writings are lost, but we can recreate them to some extent from what we know from Ptolemy. Now, the interesting thing about the invention of the astrolabe is that it's not something where you sit down in, you know, somewhere, wherever you sit down and have your best ideas. I normally have them in the shower. Unfortunately, I have to take my glasses off and then I can't write them down, which is always a great loss, I think. But then maybe not. So you can't just sit down and say, I'm going to invent an astrolabe. Because you need to think about what you want to do with this. And that brings us to the point, what is an astrolabe? Now, when I work with the public in the British Museum, and I do that quite a lot with children, people, their gut reaction always is it's a very complicated instrument. And that is probably understandable, because it looks rather complicated, and there are all these markings on there, and then it's got to do with mathematics. But of course, an astrolabe is also an extremely beautiful thing. Before I get mucked on my way to the station, I should say this is a replica. Otherwise, I'd be in deep trouble in the museum, believe me. It's just an extremely beautiful thing to behold, whether one understands it or not, and I think that is part of the attraction. Now, what is an astrolabe? It's actually extremely simple. If you imagine you're traveling somewhere, anyway, normally, I think, forget about GPS. You would take a map, wouldn't you? Because that's just what you do. And you never think about what a map actually is. You wouldn't think about taking your terrestrial globe, would you? Well, that would look a bit odd. And if you live in London, as I do, on the tube would be extremely, extremely risky. And then Sylvia, you would have to restore your globe. That would be nice for Sylvia, but not so good for your globe, really. So you take a map. But of course, the Earth isn't flat. And people didn't think the Earth was flat, whatever people might read in textbooks. A map is just a projection of the three-dimensional terrestrial globe onto two dimensions. It's very, very simple. And the astrolabe is basically just the projection of the three dimensions, star and sky around us, into two dimensions. Just something we don't use that frequently, otherwise we would be equally used to it. And of course, there's always a story related to this, and this story often comes from the Islamic world. Why? We'll come to in a moment. How an astrolabe was invented, nothing to do with showers. But Ptolemy was riding on his donkey, holding his celestial globe. And being a bit absent-minded, as academics are, he dropped it, and he trod on it, and that was the beginning of an astrolabe. Now, that sort of explains to you roughly what, but of course, think about all those things happening in the sky. You won't like a map. It doesn't help you if, you know, the way to Norfolk is in that direction, but on the map it's actually in that direction, won't help you. So your stars also have to have the same distances when they're projected, and the circles have to remain circles, otherwise you can't do anything with it. And that is, to project that and to have the theory for that is actually extremely clever. It is called stereographic projection, and it's believed that Hipparchus, whom I've mentioned earlier, came up with that idea. So without stereographic projection, no astrolabe. So that is roughly the origin of the astrolabe, and there are, of course, quite a number of early treatises on the subject, but it all doesn't really kick off properly until a much later date, the 9th, 10th century. That is when we really have the earliest Islamic instruments, and then the European ones a little later, as I've just said. And around 1300... instruments, astrolabes, become far more common. And the European type starts looking, when you go to the galleries upstairs, which I urge you to do, not now, because I think they're closed, but another time, you will find certain common elements, which brings us to the point who used an astrolabe in the European Middle Ages. Because when you look at it, that's the same instrument, just on the right-hand side is black and white image, because that's easier to photograph that enormous amount of things going on in the back. This is the famous Sloane astrolabe in the British Museum. Oxford website was down yesterday, so I have to use our instruments. We wasn't intended, but hey. It's this size. It's really, really huge. And not really practical to use if you compare them with the small one I have with me, if you want to do observations and you have a weight like that on your arm. So what were people doing with it? Well, firstly, let's look at some features which are very, very common, which you find at this time, which was Gothic patrol. So very common design. And if you could see those star pointers, those bits sticking out at the front, which indicate the stars to you. These bits here, they're actually not just things sticking out. Next time you are at the British Museum, have a close look. It's on display in our Enlightenment Gallery. They are mythical beasts. They're tongues of dogs and tons of fabulous creatures sticking out. But the point I want to make you aware of is actually the back. Because you may think this looks terribly crowded on the back, and it is. And when we a little later discuss what you use an astrolabe for, you may think, well, why do I need all these things on the back? And what you find there is a perpetual calendar, one which enables you to calculate all the movable feasts, you know, all the feasts which depend on the date of Easter, like Pentecost and Ascension and Corpus Christi, all of those, to a perpetual calendar to calculate all of those, a perpetual Easter calendar, a Saint's Day calendar, which actually enables us to locate this instrument because one of the saints only celebrated in England on this particular date. But there is very little which you think is absolutely necessary for doing astronomical observations. And at that time, it is probably likely that people used this instrument for slightly different reasons, more as a theoretical object, something to discuss, rather than a practical object for observation. Now, this is a very bold claim, and I just want to look into some details here to see whether we can actually ascertain that. And I've just chosen a court in the Middle Ages, which I'm particularly fond of, and that's the court of Frederick II, the Staufer, in Sicily. Now, you may have heard of Frederick II. He's particularly famous for having created a court where Muslim, Jewish and Christian scholars could work together. We're talking about the first half of the 13th century here, so until 1250. And he spoke probably Arabic himself, so immense access to knowledge here. And he's always associated with bringing all this knowledge together. Now, there's one scholar who is particularly well known at his court, and there's a number of manuscripts of him here in Oxford, and that's the one I've chosen here. That's the one, Frederick II at the top, but the manuscript below is a manuscript by an astrologer called Michael Scott, or Michael Scotus. Now, Michael Scotus is the golden boy of Frederick II's court. He is famed for his phenomenal knowledge. He knew languages, as praised in paper records for his translations, and is generally credited with introducing an enormous amount of the newfound knowledge from the translations into Europe. Now, in one of the texts which describe Frederick II, quite a few of those chronicles are rather negative. And the reason why they're negative is because Frederick II, whilst the Crusades were in full swing, had a treatise or a treaty between Sultan al-Kamil to just have peace so he could enter Jerusalem rather than carrying on the fighting. And that was seen rather negatively by contemporaries. And there are also other things about Frederick II which seemed a bit suspicious. By later scholars, he's normally described as a Renaissance man, which is a label you get when you're generally meant to be ahead of your time in the Middle Ages, not being quite clear what this actually means. But Frederick II, was clearly very proud on his astronomer, Michael Scott. And one of the later chroniclers describes a scene at the court because clearly Frederick occasionally needed a bit of assurance that his astronomer was really as good as he said. So one day, while residing in a certain palace, Frederick II asked his astrologer, Michael Scott, how far the palace was away from the sky. The palace where they were sitting. Having received a satisfactory answer, we're not told how, Frederick subsequently sent Michael to other parts of his empire under pretense of a pleasure trip, which is quite nice. In the meantime, however, he ordered his architects and builders to lower the height of the palace in such a subtle way that nobody would notice. When Michael finally returned, the emperor casually asked him whether the palace still had the same height or the same distance from the sky. Michael dutifully did his calculations and claimed that either the sky had risen or the palace had sunk into the ground. And it was thus that the emperor appreciated that Michael Scott was a real astrologer. Now, there are two things here where you think, what does that have to do with astrolabes? Well, an awful lot, actually. Because this passage has always been used to, Frederick II does strange things, constantly tests people at his court, is a bit suspicious, and how did Michael Scott do it? Anyway, well, very simply. And we've got a drawing on that of that on the left-hand side, and I'll just say simple trigonometry. Because one thing you can do with the astrolabe is to measure heights of buildings. Now, we know that Michael Scott was aware of an astrolabe because he mentions it several times in his text. So what he did was just basically measure the height of the building before and after. Relatively simple to do. So, great, prove that the astrolabe was used in the Middle Ages. But not so much when you look at Michael Scott's own texts. The famous Liber Introductorius, that's an introduction to astronomy and astrology, mentions the astrolabe again and again about all of this can be proven with the astrolabe, so I got quite excited by that, and started recalculating the dates which were given for the risings and settings of certain stars in the text. This is something which you can really quite easily check with the astrolabe, if I'm just correct or not. Now, these dates are widely out. They're copied from Pliny, so they're about 1250 years out, and Pliny already copied them from an earlier source. They were already out at his time, And all of this could easily have been checked. And we can see from the text that Michael Scott never, ever looked at the sky. Now, this is not actually an exception, because it has been shown by one of our colleagues, Paul Kunitz, who knows an awful lot about the matter, that until John of London, until 1260, there is no evidence for actual observation. But people look up. There's no evidence. That's amazing. So what did they do with the astrolabe? So probably used it as a calculating device, probably used it in this way, and definitely an object which was used for discussion and as a mnemonic device. But the astronomical part, actual observation, comes much later. Now, who produced astrolabes? Now, you've all seen, I'm sure you've all seen the lovely Mizan exhibition, which is on just around the corner here. With this wonderful map of the Mediterranean and astrolabes from the various regions plonked on top of it. I thought it was so beautiful that there was no way I could possibly repeat this here. So we are doing something a little different. We are not looking at the regions where the astrolabes came from, the Islamic ones, but we are looking at three completely different countries. Because what you're looking at here, and that's the power of PowerPoint, I've just extended and stretched them in all the same size roughly, they're actually quite different sizes, is on the top left, the Sloane astrolabe, which we've already seen from around 1300. On the right-hand side, an utterly stunning instrument, which is also in the British Museum, and which we will see again a little later. When you look closely, you can see the court jesters, the lovely creatures at the tip of the hand, and the tip of the tail, and the wing. Those are the star pointers. Really stunning. That is a little earlier, from a completely different region, from the Jazeera, the area in Saudi Arabia. And in the middle is a piece which I'm particularly attached to, the only instrument which made it into our famous collaboration with the BBC, History of the World in 100 Objects, Object 62, if you want to know, since you're asking, it is an instrument, an astrolabe with Hebrew markings. Now, that is extremely rare. It is so phenomenally rare that we've just got an AHRC grant to research this further, which is really rather nice, which I'm co-directing with the Warburg Institute on the role of astrolabes in medieval Jewish culture, because we know virtually nothing about this. Now, as you can see, the instrument looks relatively similar. What changes is the design at the front, the so-called Riti. Riti being Latin for weapon or net, and you can see why. It's a cut-out piece of metal, which is where really the artists came to the forefront. That's where they really put all their skill into it. Because you could just have a pointer poking out and stars there. But you don't get that. You get that very, very, at the very beginning, very early instruments, and then they become more and more beautiful. But what is so stunning about the Hebrew instrument, I mentioned the quatrefoils on the English instrument on the left, but if you look closely, you see those in here as well. Can you just see those? Yeah? And the design of the instrument, otherwise the Riti, the shape of the Riti. So we've got Gothic quatrefoils, we've got the shape of the Riti, which is sort of Moorish, which we always say is sort of, you know, Spain or North Africa, and Hebrew markings. Now, in this one instrument, we've got all the transfer of knowledge between those three cultures and the so-called Comimentia in Spain. All in one piece. Nothing, that's quite fast. So, that is where you get them. So, each of those three cultures produces instruments in different types, different sizes, different decorations, but they all exist, they're discussed, and they play a role far beyond the actual observation, as we've already seen. Now let's just look at how they are depicted in manuscripts. I've chosen three different ones here. It's a bit of a random selection because I just like them. And again, there are three completely different cultures. The one on the right-hand side comes from the British Library. And if you can just see, because it's all a bit beige-ish, it's difficult to see, there are astronomers there using various instruments, and the two men looking up the sky are using astrolabes. So in this case, they're not described as astronomers, though. They're described as astrologers. So what are they doing? In the middle, we've got a scholarly scene, a teacher holding up an astrolabe, describing to his pupils how it works, and looking into details of the terminology, because the astrolabe in the among Jewish scholars, it has played a really, really quite important role which goes beyond the astronomy. Because, just imagine, you get this wonderful text, this wonderful Arabic text, which tells you all about the astrolabe. They want to translate it. But you've never heard about an astrolabe. So where's the terminology coming from? What do you translate it into? That's a really challenging thing to do. So a whole new terminology is being developed. And a whole discussion springs up around this instrument, the astrolabe. And then we find the terminology which is developed around it going back into commentaries of the Torah, for example. So there's a real interchange going on here. And on the left-hand side, we've got a scene which is one of our favorite scenes, and I mean sort of us instrument people. We use it all the time for all sorts of reasons. And what is depicted here is an observatory, quite a famous observatory in Istanbul. And one of the two men, whom I've circled here, with a big turban, a bigger turban that you're rather more important than the other people on the ground, is a person called Taqi ad-Din. Now, Taqi ad-Din was quite a well-known astronomer in the 16th century at the court of Murad III, the Sultan. Murad III is the grandson of Suleiman the Magnificent. And he has, Taqi ad-Din has just managed to have himself an observatory built. And the instruments are clearly used for teaching, for discussion. If you look closely, there are even some instruments which are imported from Europe. So there's quite a lot of exchange going on. But there's something else going on, which is not so clear in this picture, but which the one on the right-hand side, the astrologers, already hints at. And that is the combination of, or the very close link, the relationship between astronomy and astrology. And some of my colleagues, actually my own supervisor and revered teacher, would say anything which has to do with astrology or instruments or astrology, rather, he would just ignore, because it's not proper science and it has nothing to do with astronomy. Slightly debatable point of view. But when you look closely, you'll find it actually has an awful lot to do with astrolabes. Because this observatory, when you go to Istanbul nowadays, and maybe some of you have been, and you'll think, why didn't I see that observatory? That's rather fabulous. Where was that? Well, the reason why you're not seeing it, it overlooks Topane, so it's on the European side. Why you're not seeing it is because it was destroyed shortly after it was built. Now, why would one destroy an observatory shortly after one's built it? And that has, again, to do with the ambiguous role of the astronomer and the person using the instrument here. Because shortly after the observatory was built, the scene on the right hand had, a comet was spotted over Istanbul. In the famous comet of 1577, which is also described elsewhere, and the person who is observing it there is using a particularly nice instrument. That's actually called an astrolabe quadrant. If you think astrolabes are rather boring, you know, simple, you just fold it twice, all the markings on top of each other, then you've got an astrolabe quadrant. It's even more portable, and it does all the same things. So that's what he's doing. So he's observing a comet with an astrolabe quadrant there. And Taqi ad-Din, in his role as astronomer and astrologer, was asked to give a prediction what this comet might mean. So he did. And described it as a harbinger of good tidings and a sign of the success of the Turkish army against Persia. And there's a lovely poem here, which I would like to read you a few lines. A strong flame, one of those stellar bodies referred to as the seven sinister objects, suddenly appeared on the first night of Ramadan and shone as a strong and clear light.
Like a turban sash over the also made of stars, it soared like a sun for many nights. Through it, the knights of the Moslems became blessed. As its appearance was in the house of Sagittarius, its arrow promptly fell upon the enemies of the religion. The wise and sagacious men of learning, Taqi ad-Din, the virtuous and illustrious men of wisdom, worked for many nights, without food and rest, to determine the implications of the appearance of this fiery body. He quickly wrote the astrological predictions and presented them to the King of Kings. He said, "O world-swaying king, there are joyful tidings for you concerning the conquest of Persia. But for Persia, it's a bolt of misfortune." Not quite. Unfortunately, the campaign went badly wrong. The Turkish army was completely squashed. Plague broke out. Many important people died during that year. And when you're in an important position like Taqi ad-Din, you have enemies at court. And one of those said, "Observatories are actually a thing against God, because by prying into nature, you're doing something which you shouldn't be doing. And just look," he said, "at other observatories and what happened. Look at Ulugh Beg, for example, and his famous observatory at Samarkand. Well, Ulugh Beg took a very bad end. And then the Ilkhanid Empire and the famous observatory at Marara, the empire crumbled very quickly. So let's just get rid of this observatory, because this man clearly doesn't know what he's doing." And if you nowadays look for the books, which are nicely lying on top of each other, at the back of this bookcase there, which is the way books would have been stored, go to Leiden University Library, because they were sold off. After the destruction of the observatory, you still find Taqi ad-Din's sleepers in there. So it shows you how important astrology and the role of the astrolabes is when you look at it together. And here's another example. The astrolabe must have been understood in symbolism. Otherwise, people wouldn't have understood this story. This is a story from 1001 Nights. A story where Scheherazade talks about the barber of Baghdad. It's the 144th night, if you want to read it up. But in case you don't have your 1001 nights with you, let me do it for you. "I said to the barber," it's a young man, "I'm still weak from my illness." Well, he's a little poorly. And he wants to visit his lover, who's a married woman. And he thinks, well, I better be well shaped before I do that. Good start. So he calls the barber. "And I'm still weak from my illness." Then he, the barber, put his hand in his leather bag and took out an astrolabe with 7 plates inlaid with silver, and, going into the courtyard, that's the scene we've got here, held the instrument up to the sun's rays and looked for some time. Then he said to me, "Oh, my lord, 8 degrees and 6 minutes have elapsed on this day, which is Friday, the 18th of Safar, in the 653rd year of Hijran, the 7,320th year of the Alexandra era. And the planet now in the ascendant, according to the mathematical calculations on the astrolabe, is Mars, which in the conjunction with Mercury, a conjunction that is favorable for cutting hair." See what astrolabes can do. "I can also see that you intend to meet another person. And for that, the time is inauspicious and ill-advised." So, if people at the time would not have had any idea what an astrolabe is, this would not have meant anything to them. But clearly the connotation at this point is the use of an astrolabe for some observation with planetary positions, which an astrolabe can actually not do in this way, as it's described, but also for predictions of the future. He's actually right, and the meeting with the man's lover goes badly wrong, her husband comes back, and it all really deteriorates into very bad things. But in case you're music lovers, I urge you to listen to Peter Cornelius, The Barber of Baghdad, which is a comic opera, which describes this scene in great detail, and is actually rather fun to listen to. Now, we're talking about astrology already, and I've just turned another astrolabe round and looked at its back. We've looked at the back of the English astrolabe earlier, where there were just calendars, you know, mnemonic devices. You've got the same information in almanac. But what you have here is actually pure astrology. And if you look at the cutout, which I've taken there and blown up a little bit, you may think these are just the signs of the zodiac. They're quite common on the back of an astrolabe, where you just divide the path of the sun into 12 signs. But when you look closely, there are too many. There are 24. And what you get here is actually the sign of the zodiac with its planetary ruler. And that is rather nice. So you've got Taurus here with Venus. Venus is particularly strong in Taurus. On Mars, wielding a sword in Aries. Those two go very closely together. And the rest of the instrument, all of those markings here, have nothing to do with astronomy whatsoever. They're all astrological tables. So clearly the astrolabe is also a repository for astrological information and is used in an astrological context. Now, this is an instrument which I've shown you earlier. It's in the British Museum, made by a person called Abdul Karim in the 13th century. And there's a second Abdul Karim astrolabe, which is here, upstairs. And I'm just showing you the back, because the front isn't quite so spectacular. It's lost its original front, its riti. But when you look at that closely, this quarter here, and you may just about see this row there. I'm not sure whether you can see that clearly from the back, so let me just tell you. They're the signs of the zodiac. And this time we don't get the planets. We get something completely different. We get the signs of the zodiac as seen in sky view, which is when you look up and see them, and in globe view. Now, globe view is the imagination that you look at the world, the sky, from the outside, that God would do. So in sky view, I'm wielding a sword like that. In globe view, I'll be wielding a sword like that. Yeah? Or rather like that. But because in the Islamic world, somebody isn't depicted from the back, now I'm still wielding my sword on the right, but my head would turn 80 degrees. Can you imagine that? Yeah? So, my right arm is no longer my right arm, but my left arm. And that is why this is a completely different view. And this is very described in great detail by a famous astronomer called Sufi, Persian astronomer around the year 1000. So this is pretty unique on an instrument. So you can boost depictions which you otherwise only find in manuscripts. But what's rather more exciting, and a subject of which I've spilled an enormous amount of ink, is this bit here. Now, you don't find that any other astrolabe in the world, she says boldly, there's always one which will pop up from nowhere. This is a feature which is something I'm immensely fascinated by. Now, you all know about the signs of the zodiac, yeah? The path of the sun divided into 12 parts. Aries, Taurus, yeah? All of you? Now, in the Islamic world, it's a concept which actually originally comes from India. Excuse me. A concept which originally comes from India, the path of the moon is also divided. Now imagine you're a Bedouin, you're sitting in the desert, and it's dark. Far easier than observing the sun, it's observing the moon. It's only 28, 29 days and it comes back with the crescent moon. There's a lovely crescent moon outside, very easy to observe. So the path of the moon is divided into equal paths. These parts are called lunar mentions. They're 28 normally, and they're used for astrological purposes, but also for meteorological purposes. And you find them, amongst other things, on this astrolabe. And the rest of the back is inscribed with astrological markings like the other one. So astrology clearly plays quite an important role when we think about astrolabes. But now let's come to the point which is always, you always read that in textbooks, on Wikipedia. Love Wikipedia. An astrolabe was invented by the Muslims because they were a seafaring nation, and that is a little bit problematic, unless at the beginning you count a camel in the desert. But
you often, well, not that often actually, but you find the astrolabe, and I've circled it up there so you can see it because it's a little bit difficult to see in those two images, clearly employed in navigation. Now, this seems to be a slightly precarious job, sitting right up there in the crater, holding your astrolabe and doing something with it. Now, I fear this is wrong. You don't use an astrolabe for what you might think you use it for. Not this type of astrolabe. Because imagine a tossing and turning ship. You have this in your hand, and you're trying with this back, with this thing here on the back, which are sighting mains, so-called in Alidae, you're trying to see something through that or take measurements. But now the ship is tossing and turning, not particularly precise. So you would use another instrument, which is also called an astrolabe, rather confusingly, but a mariner's astrolabe, a sea-going astrolabe, which is actually not an Islamic instrument. So, interestingly, even on contemporary miniatures, it was assumed that this is something the astrolabe could do, although you can see from the way it's held sort of here, it's a bit unclear what they're actually doing. The one on the left is clearly helping Noah out, because that's Noah's ark, and we all know what happened to that, so he must have done something right. Now, let's come to the point which is really important. And that is why the astrolabe is such a popular instrument in the Islamic world. I've mentioned that there are relatively few early European ones. There's a huge amount of instruments from the Islamic world, astrolabes from the Islamic world. Now, why is that? Now, think about what Islam is about. We have the five pillars of Islam, which are about prayer, which are about fasting in Ramadan. It's about going on pilgrimage. It's about giving alms to the poor. And, of course, expressing your faith. And if you look at those, thinking about prayer, thinking about fasting, prayer is for every Muslim, not just for a small group like monks in a Christian monastery or for Sundays. Every Muslim, you will have observed that in Islamic countries, prays 5 times a day. Now, you may have traveled in Islamic countries and wondered why, when you want to visit a mosque, it just doesn't just say, well, visiting times 9 to 10, 3 to 4, and 6 to 8. But the visiting times change on a daily basis. Well, that's rather tedious when you are a tourist and the your guide doesn't tell you why. The reason why has to do with the way hours are counted or calculated in the Islamic world, actually a way in which they were counted in Europe as well until clocks came in. We are used to hours, the day, being divided into 24 parts of equal length. We're just so used to it, we don't think about it. So 4 o'clock in winter, just probably already beginning to be dark, 4 o'clock in summer, we'll just be out there having a lovely picnic, because it's still very light. Now this, of course, is a complete divorce us from what's going on in the heavens. And until the 14th century, 15th century in Europe, a different system was used, and in the Islamic world, it's still used for prayer times. And that is something which is rather straightforward when you think about it. You divide the day between sunrise and sunset into 12 parts. Now, this length of daylight comes longer and longer and longer in summer, and shorter and shorter and shorter in winter. They're the so-called unequal hours. Very alien concept for us nowadays, but very, very useful for people at the time, because you were not in the slightest bit interested about the 6 o'clock. You were interested in how much daylight you had left to plow your feet, or when you really had to get back into town because you were travelling through a forest and that was rather dangerous. So you were interested in the time of daylight. Now an astrolabe can do that. An astrolabe can indicate, for the many purposes which I've already mentioned, sort of in passing, things the astrolabe can do. Timekeeping is one of its most important features. And it can keep time in the way we're used to, but also in this unequal hours. Now, prayer times in Islam are based on those unequal hours. They're based on shadow and twilight phenomena. How much time has passed until a stick in the ground has cast a shadow. When this shadow is cast, it's time for the first afternoon prayer, for example. fox. Don't tell my colleagues. Are utterly useless. They really are. Lovely, lovely automata. But for this, I work in a clock department, so I'm very careful here. They are really lovely automata for regular things. Could it be, you know, rabbits popping out of a hat or a hand going round? But for this kind of time, they're useless. And this is why you don't find them in the astronomy world as a timekeeping instrument. There's nothing to do with people not being able to make them. They're just not useful. So they get introduced as gadgets. You know, like somebody may take away an obelisk and put it on South Bank because, hey, wouldn't it be nice to have an obelisk? European clocks get introduced into the Islamic world as gadgets, as an export object, often asked for specifically as a diplomatic gift. Now, what we need is an object, an instrument, some feature which enables us to calculate prayer times. We also need to pray in the direction of Mecca, the Kaaba, which we have at the top left here, the holy shrine in Mecca, which of course is easy whilst you're in Mecca, but the further and greater the Islamic empire becomes, the more difficult it becomes. Where is Mecca? Really important. And we've got on the second picture on the left, the prayer direction, the mihrab, the direction of prayer being indicated in every mosque. Easy as long as you're in a mosque. But imagine you're not. And then, of course, the crescent moon, which we've mentioned earlier. The calendar, which is the underlying feature of the Islamic world, is not the calendar we use nowadays for practical purposes, but the religious calendar is based on the moon. And the month starts with the first sighting of the lunar crescent. And fasting in Ramadan starts just after sunrise and ends after sunset. And all of those things, all of those, you can calculate with an astronaut. And that explains why this instrument is so popular in the Islamic world. And the only instrument I'm showing here yet again is an astrolabe quadrant. That's an astrolabe folded twice into a quarter of a circle. And the reason why I'm showing this is because it's made for Al-Mizi, the Muwakkit, the timekeeper, literally, of the mosque of Damascus. So the person who was in charge of time and of prayer had an instrument to tell others. And that really is one of the most important features of an astrolabe. But another one, of course, is symbolism. And again, there are some examples in the show, in the Mizan, but I just want to show you one which comes again from our collections. It's on display in the Enlightenment Gallery. And you will see in this triangular part at the top, which we call the throne, for various quite illogical reasons. In that is a silver inlaid bit. Can you see that? That says Shah Hussein. It's an astrolabe made for the last of the Safavid, that's a Persian dynasty rulers, in 1712. And the text in there says, and I'm using the translation here, given that we're in Oxford, the translation from Morley, who first described this instrument here in Oxford, in conformity with the mandate flowing like fate of the Sultan of the Sultans of the world, the Lord of the Emperors of the age, slightly flowering, the protector and asylum of the people of the faith, the benefactor of the universe and of mankind, the center of the sphere of power and justice, the pole of the supreme heaven of magnificence and grandeur, the flashing star of the apogee of world conquest, the resplendent sun of the midst of the heavens of world government, Shah Sultan Hussein, Sahwi Muawiyah Husseini. So this instrument, which is made very late in the 18th century, when astrolabes are getting a little bit out of fashion, it's immensely, this large, it's all inlaid with silver, it's immensely heavy. You wouldn't use it like the one I've shown you. This is a symbol for the Sultan being the center of the sphere, the center of the universe, the planets circling around it. It really is a symbolic instrument, a celestial metaphor, if you like. And there are other examples of that. There's another one in the Mizan exhibition. So that is relatively common. So an astrolabe takes on a completely different role. And in the Renaissance, we have instruments, in the European Renaissance I'm talking now, we have instruments which are used for observations. Astrolabe becomes very popular. But also,
again, because of this celestial metaphor, becomes a symbol of knowledge. You know, the Renaissance trying to understand the universe, trying to show that you know what's going on, even if you may not fully understand it. An astrolabe is a perfect example. Now, what we're looking at here is the so-called studiolo, that's a small room in Urbino of Federico de Montefeltro. It's all inlaid wood. And one of the intarsia is a little blurry, but I think you can see the astrolabe there on the left-hand side. Yeah? We can identify that astrolabe. That has survived. It's a real thing. So there is a lot going on here which goes far beyond the astronomical or astrological uses of the instrument. Now, I brought this astrolabe along to get a volunteer to do some sightings with it, but I think we'll leave that to volunteers a little later because we're running out of time. But to sum up, really, the astrolabe is a lot more than an instrument. It has manifold faces which go far beyond the top layer. And this fascination is still going on. Now, I've showed you one image earlier. Let me show you another one. Any volunteers what that is? Come on, younger generation in the audience. No? Better? Yeah? And if you haven't watched your film properly, look at it again, because there are a number of instruments there, and right circle, there is an astrolabe. Now, it's never explained in the film why they're there, but they symbolize that Professor Dumbledore has enormous knowledge. Some of it arcane, not open to others, but he understands what's going on. And I think that's actually rather beautiful, that the instrument in this configuration has survived until today. So I'd like to thank you for your attention. It's pretty much exactly 8 o'clock. And if you have any questions...